5 or 6 years older than she is. A bounce in his step as he moves up the line. She edges a little closer to him. The tag on his bag reads, Doctors Without Borders. The security guard bristles and examines his passport.
Are you carrying any liquid, sir?
Just 8 pints.
Excuse me, sir?
8 pints of blood. I don't think they'll spill. He taps his chest and she chuckles. She can tell that he's Italian, the words stretched with a lyrical curl. He turns to her and smiles, but the security guard stands back, stares at the man as if at a painting, and then says,
Sir, I need you to step out of line, please.
Excuse me?
Step out of line, please. Now.
2 other guards swing across.
Listen, I'm only joking, says the Italian.
Sir, follow us, please.
Just a joke, he says.
He's pushed in the back toward an office.
I'm a doctor. I was just making a joke. Just carrying 8 pints of blood, that's all. A joke. A bad one. That's all.
He flings out his hands to plead, but his arm is twisted high behind his back, and the door is closed behind him with a thump. The ranker passes down the line to her and the other passengers in the security area. She feels a thread of cold along her neck as the security guard stares her down. She has a bottle of perfume sealed in a little Ziploc bag, and she places it carefully in the tray.
Why are you bringing this in carry-on, miss?
It's less than 3 ounces.
And the purpose of your travel?
Personal, to see a friend.
And what's your final destination, miss?
New York.
Business or pleasure?
Pleasure, she says, the word catching at the back of her throat. She answers calmly, practiced, controlled, and when she goes through the metal detector, she automatically stretches her arms out to be searched, even though she doesn't set off the alarm. The plane is near empty. The Italian finally slouches on, quiet, embarrassed, contrite. He has a hunch to his shoulders as if he can't quite deal with his height. His light brown hair in a havoc. A small shadow of gray-tinged beard on his chin. He catches her eye as he takes the seat behind her. A smile travels between them. She can hear him behind her as he takes off his leather jacket and sighs down into his place. Halfway through the flight, she orders a gin and tonic, and he extends a $20 bill across the seat to pay for her drink.
They used to give these things out free, he says.
You're used to traveling in style?
She's annoyed at herself. She didn't mean to be so curt.
But sometimes it happens. The words come out at the wrong angle, like she's on the defensive from the very beginning.
No, not me. He says,
Style and I never got along. She can tell it's true. The wide collar on his shirt, an ink spot on the breast pocket. He looks like the sort of man who might give himself his own haircut. Not your normal Italian, but what's a normal Italian anyway? She's grown tired of the people who tell her that she's not a normal African American, as if there were only one great big normal box that everyone had to pop out of. The Swedish, the Poles, the Mexicans. And what did they mean anyway that she wasn't normal? That she didn't wear gold hoop earrings? That she moved tightly, dressed tightly, kept everything in line?
So, she says, what did they tell you in the airport?
Not to make jokes anymore.
God bless America.
The bad joke police. Did you hear the one...
No.
About the man who went to the doctor's office with a carrot up his nose?
Already she is laughing. He gestures to the aisle seat. Please, yes. She is surprised by the immediate comfort she feels, inviting him to sit, even turning toward him, bridging the distance over the middle seat. She's often nervous around men and women her own age, their attention, their desires. A tall, willowy beauty, she has cinnamon skin, white teeth, serious lips, no makeup,
but her dark eyes always seem to want to escape her good looks. It adds up to a strange force around her. She strikes people as intelligent and dangerous. An other land stranger. Sometimes she tries to claw her way through the awkwardness, but falls back down, suffocating. It's as if she feels it all bubbling up inside, all that wild ancestry, but she can't get it to boil. At work, she's known as one of the bosses with ice in her veins. If there's a joke email sent around the offices, she's seldom copied on it. She would love to be, but seldom is, even among her closest colleagues. In the foundation, the volunteers talk about her behind her back. When she steps into jeans and a t-shirt to join them in the field, there's always something stiff about it. Her shoulders in a controlled line, her demeanor mannered. And the doctor says, I know exactly what's wrong with you. Yes, you're not eating properly. Bada boom, she says, bringing her head alarmingly close to his shoulder. 4 small plastic bottles of gin rattle on his airplane tray. He is, she thinks, already too complicated. He's from Genoa and divorced, with 2 children. He has worked in Africa, Russia, and Haiti, and spent 2 years in New Orleans working as a doctor in the 9th Ward. He's just moved to Little Rock, he says, where he runs a small mobile clinic for veterans home from the wars. Pino, he says, extending his hand. Jaslyn. And you? He asks. Me? A charm in his eyes. What about you? What can she tell him? That she comes from a long line of hookers? That her grandmother died in a prison cell? That she and her sister were adopted, grew up in Poughkeepsie? Their mother, Gloria, went around the house singing bad opera? That she got sent to Yale while her sister chose to join the army? That she was in the theater department and that she failed to make it? That she changed her name from Jaslyn to Jaslyn? That it wasn't from shame? Not from shame at all? That Gloria said there was no such thing as shame? That life was about a refusal to be shamed? Well, I'm sort of an accountant, she says. A sort of accountant. Well, I'm at a small foundation. We help with tax preparation. It's not what I thought I'd do, I mean, when I was younger, but I like it. It's good. We go around the trailer parks and hotels and all, after Rita and Katrina and all. We help people fill out their tax forms and take care of things, because often they don't even have their driver's license anymore. Great country. She eyes him suspiciously, but wonders if perhaps he means it. He could. It's possible, she thinks. Why not? Even in these times. The more he talks, the more she notices that his accent has a couple of continents in it, like it has landed in each place and picked up a few sounds in each. He tells her the story of how as a child in Genoa, he used to go to the soccer games and help bandage the wounded who were involved in stadium fights. Serious injuries, he says, especially when Sampdoria played Lazio. Sorry? You have no idea what I'm talking about, do you? No, she laughs. He cracks the small seal on another bottle of gin, pours half in her glass, half in his own. She feels herself loosening further around him. Well, she says, I once worked at McDonald's. You're kidding! Kind of. I tried to be an actor. Same thing, really. Learn your lines. You want fries with that? Hit your mark. You want fries with that? Film? Theater. She reaches across for her glass, lifts it, drinks. It's the first time in years that she's opened herself to a stranger. It's as if she's bitten into the skin of an apricot. Cheers. Salute, he says in Italian. The plane banks out over the city, storm clouds and a driving rain against the windows. The lights of New York like shadows of light under the clouds,
ghostly, rain dampened, dim.
So, he says, gesturing out the window, the darkness webbed over Kennedy.
Excuse me?
New York. You staying long?
Oh, I'm going to see an old friend, she says.
I see. How old?
Very old.
When she was young and not so shy, she used to love going out on the street in Poughkeepsie, outside their small house, where she would run along with one foot on the pavement and the other on the road. It took some gymnastics. She had to extend one leg and keep the other slightly bent, running at close to full pace. Claire came to visit in a chauffeured town car. Once she sat and watched the trick for a long time with delight, and said that Jaslyn was running an extended entrechat, half on, half off, half on, half off, half on. Later, Claire sat with Gloria on wooden chairs in the back garden by the plastic pool near the red fence. They looked so different. Claire in her neat skirt, Gloria in her flowered dress, as if they too were running on different levels of pavement, but in the same body, the two of them combined. At the luggage carousel, Pino waits beside her. He has no suitcase to pick up. She rubs her hands together, nervously. Why still this small feeling of tightness at her core? Not even her own two gin and tonics have done their work. But he too is edgy, she notices, as he moves from foot to foot and adjusts his shoulder bag. She likes his nervousness. It brings him down to earth, makes him solid. He has already suggested that he can share a taxi with her into Manhattan if she'd like. He's on his way to the village, wants to hear some jazz. She wants to tell him that he doesn't look like a jazz man, that there's something folk rock about him, that he might fit well into a Bob Dylan song, or he might be found with the liner notes for Springsteen in his pocket. But jazz doesn't fit. Yet she likes complications. She wishes she could turn and say, I like people who unbalance me. So much of her time spent like this, dreaming up things to say and never quite saying them. If only she could turn to Pino and say that she'll come with him tonight, to a jazz club, sit at a table with a tasseled lamp, feel the saxophone trill through her, stand and move to the tiny dance floor and align her long body against his, maybe even allow him to rub his lips along her neck. She watches the line of suitcases tumble from the conveyor belt onto the carousel below, none of them hers. A group of kids on the far side jump on and off the carousel to the amusement of their parents. She waves across and mugs a face at the youngest, who is perched atop a giant red suitcase. Your children, she says as she turns to Pino. Do you have photographs? A silly, awkward question. She has spoken without thinking, leaned too close to him, asked too much. But he pulls out a cell phone and scrolls through the pictures, shows her a young teenage girl, dark, serious, attractive. He starts to scroll again for a picture of his boy when a security guard comes right up beside him.
No cell phone use in the terminal, sir.
Excuse me?
No cell phones, no cameras.
Not your day, she says, smiling, as she leans down to pick up her small traveling bag.
Maybe, maybe not, he says.
Across the way, a high yelp. The kids riding suitcases on the moving carousel have fallen afoul of the security guard, too. She and Pino turn to each other. She feels much younger all of a sudden. The thrill of flirtation. Her whole body shot through with lightness. As they step from the terminal, he says that they'll take the Queensboro Bridge if that's okay with her. He will drop her off first and then go downtown. So he knows the city, she thinks. He's been here before. This place belongs to him, too.
Another surprise. She always thought that one of the beauties of New York is that you can be from anywhere, and within moments of landing, it's yours. Sabine Pass and Johnson's Bayou, Beauregard and Vermilion, Acadia and New Iberia, Maryville and DeRidder, Thibodeau and Port Bolivar, Napoleonville and Slaughter, Point Cadet and Casino Row, Moss Point and Pass Christian, Escambia and Walton, Diamond Head and Jones Mill, Americus, America. Names in her mind, flooding. Rain outside the terminal. He stands under a small ledge, pulls a packet of cigarettes from his inside pocket. He tamps the pack with the heel of his hand, shifts the cigarette upward, offers it. She shakes her head no. She used to smoke, not anymore. An old habit from her days at Yale. Almost everyone in the theater smoked. But she likes the fact that he lights up and lets the smoke blow in her direction, that it will get in her hair, that she will own the scent of it later. The taxi slides through the rain. The last of the storm has blown over the city, a final exhausted bow, an endfall. He hands her a card before the taxi pulls in by the awning on Park Avenue. He scribbles his name and the number of his cell on the back. "Fancy," he says, surveying the street. He picks her small bag out of the back of the cab, leans across and kisses her on each cheek. She notices with a smile that he has one foot on, one foot off the curb. He fumbles in his pocket. She looks away and she hears a sudden click. He's taken her photograph with his cell phone. She's not quite sure how to respond. Erase it? File it? Make it his screensaver? She thinks of herself there, pixelated, alongside his children, carried around in his pocket, to his jazz club, to his clinic, to his home. She's never done this with a man before, but she takes her own card out and tucks it into a shirt pocket, taps it closed with the palm of her hand. She feels her face tighten again. Too forward. Too flirtatious. Too easy. It used to bother her terribly as a teenager that her mother and grandmother had worked the streets. She thought it might rebound on her someday, that she would find herself too much in love with love, or that it might be dirty, or that her friends would find out, or worse, that she might ask a boy to pay for it. She was the last of her high school friends to even kiss a boy. A kid in school once called her the reluctant African queen. Her first kiss ever was just after science class before social studies. He had a broad face and dark eyes. He held her in the doorway and kept his foot on the frame. Only the constant knocking on the door from a teacher separated them. She walked home with him that day, hand in hand, through the streets of Poughkeepsie. Gloria saw her from the porch of their small house and smiled deeply. She and the boy lasted all the way through college. She'd even contemplated marrying him, but he went to Chicago to take a trading job. She went home to Gloria then, wept for a day. Afterward, Gloria said to her that it was necessary to love silence, but before you could love silence, you have to have noise. "So you'll call me then?" she asks him. "I'll call you, yes." "Really?" she asks with arched brow. "Of course," he replies. He extends his shoulder playfully. She rocks backward as if in a cartoon, her arms spread wide, flailing. She's not sure why she does it, but for a moment she doesn't really care. There's an electricity to it. It makes her laugh. He kisses her again, this time on the lips, quickly, smartly. She almost wishes her co-workers were here, that they could see her, bidding goodbye to an Italian man, a doctor on Park Avenue, in the dark, in the cold, in the rain, in the wind, in the night. Like there might be some secret camera that beams it all back to the offices in Little Rock, everyone looking up from the tax forms to watch her wave goodbye, to see him turn his body in the back of the cab, his arm raised, a shadow on his face, a smile. She hears the hiss of the taxi tires as the car pulls away. Then she cups her hands out beyond the awning and runs some rainwater through her hair. The doorman smiles, although it's been years since she's seen him. A Welshman. He used to sing on Sundays when she, Gloria, and her sister came to visit. She can't quite recall his name. His mustache has gone gray.
Miss Jaslyn, where have you been?
And then she remembers. Melvin. He reaches for the small bag, and for a moment, she thinks he's going to say how much she's grown. But all he says in a grateful way,
they put me on the night shift.
She's not quite sure if she should kiss his cheek or not, this evening of kissing, but he solves the dilemma by turning away. Melvin, she says, you haven't changed a bit. He pats his stomach, smiles. She's wary of elevators. She'd like to take the stairs, but a teenage boy is there with his hat and white gloves on. Madame, says the elevator boy.
You staying long, Miss Jaslyn?
Asked Melvin, but already the gate is closing. She smiles at him from the back of the elevator.
I'll call up to Mrs. Soderbergh's, he says through the grill, and let them know you're here.
The elevator boy stares straight ahead. He takes great care with the Otis. He doesn't engage her in conversation, his head tilted slightly to the ceiling, and his body as if it's counting out rhythm. She gets the sense that he will be here 10 years from now, 20, 30. She would like to step up behind him and whisper, boo, in his ear, but she watches the panel and the small circular white lights as they rise. He pulls the lever, aligns the elevator and the floor perfectly. He slides his foot out to test his workmanship. A young man of precision. Madame, he says, first door on your right. The door is opened by a tall Jamaican nurse, a man. They are momentarily confused, as if they should know each other somehow. The exchange is rapid fire. I'm Mrs. Soderbergh's niece.
Oh, I see. Come in.
Not her niece, really, but she calls me her niece.
Please, come in.
I called earlier.
Yes, yes, she's sleeping now.
Step inside. How is she?
Well,
he says, and the well is drawn out. A pause, not an affirmative. Claire is not well at all. She's at the bottom of a dark well. Jaslyn hears the sound of other voices. A radio, perhaps? The apartment seems as if it's been sunk in aspic. It used to terrify her and her sister as children, on those occasions when they came into the city with Gloria. The dark hallway, the artwork, the smell of old wood. She and her sister held hands as they walked down the corridor. The worst thing was the portrait of the dead man on the wall. The painting had been done in such a way that his eyes seemed to follow them. Claire would talk about him all the time, that Solomon had loved this and Solomon loved that. She had sold some of her other paintings, even her Miro, to help pay the expenses, but the Solomon portrait remained. The nurse takes her bag and settles it in the corner against the hat stand. Please, he says, and he motions her toward the living room. She's stunned to see 6 people, most of them her own age, around the table and on the sofa. They're casually dressed, but sipping cocktails. Her heart thumps against the wall of her chest. They too freeze at the sight of her. Well, well. The true nieces, nephews, cousins, perhaps? Song of Solomon. He's dead 14 years, but she can see him in their faces. One, almost certainly, is Claire's niece, with a streak of gray in her hair. They stare at her. The air like ice around her. She wishes that she had taken Pino upstairs alongside her so he could help take control, calmly, smoothly, or at least draw attention. She can still feel the kiss on her lips. She touches them with her fingers, as if she can hold the memory of it there.
"Hi, I'm Jaslyn," she says with a wave.
An idiotic wave, presidential almost.
"Hi," says a tall brunette.
She feels as if she's been nailed to the floor, but one of the nephews strides across the room. He's something of the petulant college boy about him. Chubby face, a white shirt, a blue blazer, a red handkerchief in the breast pocket.
"Tom," he says, "lovely to meet you, Jaslyn, finally."
He says her name like something he wants to flick off his shoe, and the word finally stretches into rebuke. So he knows about her. He's heard. He probably thinks she's here to dig. So be it, gold digger. The truth is, she couldn't care less about the will. If she got anything, she would probably give it away.
"A drink?"
"I'm fine, thanks." We figured that Auntie would have wanted us to enjoy ourselves even in the worst of times. He lowers his voice. "We're making Manhattans."
"How is she?"
"She's sleeping."
"It's late. I'm terribly sorry."
"We have soda, too, if you want."
"Is she..."
She cannot finish the sentence. The words hang in the air between her and Tom.
"She's not well," he says.
That word again. A hollow echo all the way down to the ground. No splash. A constant free fall. Well. Well. She dislikes them for drinking, but then she knows she should join them, that she should not be apart. Bring Pino back. Let him slide some charm among them. Let him take her off into the evening upon his arm, nestled up against his leather jacket.
"Maybe I'll take a drink," she says.
"And so," says Tom, "what exactly brings you here?"
"Excuse me?"
"I mean, what exactly do you do now? Weren't you working for the Democrats or something?"
She hears a slight giggle from across the room. They're facing her, all of them, watching as if she has at last made it to the stage. She likes the people with the endurance to tolerate the drudge. The ones who know that pain is a requirement, not a curse. They arrange their lives in front of her. A few sheets of paper, a pay stub, a welfare check, all they have left. She adds up the figures. She knows the tax credits, the loopholes, the exits and entrances, the phone calls that must be made. She tries to nullify mortgage payments on a house that has floated down to the sea. She gets around insurance demands on cars that are at the bottom of the bayou. She tries to stop bills for very small white coffins. She's seen others from the Little Rock Foundation cleave people open immediately, but she's never been able to get to them so quickly. At first, they are stilted with her, but she has learned how to listen all the same. After a half hour or so, she gets to them. It's as if they're talking to themselves, as if she's a mirror in front of them, giving them another history of themselves. She's attracted to their darkness, but she likes the moment when they turn again and find some meaning that sideswipes them. "I really loved her. I loosened his shirt before he drifted through the floodgates. My husband put the stove on a layaway plan." And before they know it, their taxes are done. The insurance claim is laid out. The mortgage companies have been noted. The paper is slid across the table for them to sign. Sometimes it takes them an age just to sign, since they have something else to say. They're off and chatting about the cars they bought, the loves they loved. They have a deep need just to talk, just to tell a story, however small or reckless. Listening to these people is like listening to trees. Sooner or later, the tree is sliced open and the watermarks reveal their age. There was an old woman about 9 months ago. She sat in a Little Rock hotel room, her dress spread out. Jaslyn was trying to figure out payments that the woman wasn't getting from her pension fund.
"My boy was the mailman," the woman said, "right there in the ninth. He was a good boy, 22 years old. Used to work late if he had to, and he worked. I ain't lying. People loved getting his letters. They waited for him. They liked him coming knocking on the door. You listening?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"And then the storm blowed in, and he didn't come back. I was waiting. I had his dinner ready. I was living on the third floor then, waiting. Except nothing happened. So I waited and waited. I went out after 2 days looking for him, went downstairs. All those helicopters were flying over, ignoring us. I waded out into the street. I was up to my neck, near drowning. I couldn't find no sign. Nothing. Till I was down there by the check cashing store and I found the sack of mail floating. And I pulled it in. And I thought, holy."
The woman's fingers clamped down, gripping Jaslyn's hand.
"I was sure he'd come floating around the next corner alive. I looked and looked, but I never did see my boy. I wish I would have drowned right there and then. I found out 2 weeks later that he was caught up high in a treetop, just rotting in the heat, in his mailman uniform. Imagine that. Caught in the tree."
The woman got to her feet and went across the hotel room, went to a cheap dresser, yanked a drawer open.
"I still got his mail here, see? You can take it if you want it."
Jaslyn held the sack in her hands. None of the envelopes had been touched.
"Take it, please," the woman said. "I can't stand it no more."
She took the sack of letters out to the lake near natural steps at the outskirts of Little Rock. The last light of day, she walked on the bank, her shoes sinking in the loam. Birds rose by pairs, bursting upward and wheeling overhead with the sun red on their cupped underwings. She wasn't sure what she should do with the mail. She sat down on the grass and sorted them out. Magazines, flyers, personal letters to be returned with a note. "This got lost some time ago. I hope it's okay to send it on again now." She burned the bills, all of them. Verizon, Entergy, the Internal Revenue Service. That grief wouldn't be needed now. No, not anymore. She stands by the window, the dark down. A chatter in the room. She is reminded of white birds flapping. The cocktail glass she holds feels fragile. If she holds it too tight, she thinks, it might shatter. She's come to stay, to be with Claire for a day or two, to sleep in the spare room, to accompany her dying the same way she accompanied Gloria's dying 6 years ago. The slow car journey back to Missouri. A smile on Gloria's face. Her sister Janice in the front seat driving, playing games with the rearview mirror, both of them pushing Gloria in a wheelchair along the banks of the river. Up a lazy river where the robin's song wakes a brand new morning as we roll along. It was a celebration that day. They had dug their feet down into happiness and weren't prepared to let go. They threw sticks into an eddy and watched them circle, put a blanket down, ate Wonder Bread sandwiches. Later in the afternoon, her sister began crying like a change in the weather, for no reason except the popping of a wine cork. Jaslyn handed her a wadded tissue. Gloria laughed at them and said that she'd overtaken grief a long time ago, that she was tired of everyone wanting to go to heaven, nobody wanting to die. The only thing worth grieving over, she said, was that sometimes there was more beauty in this life than the world could bear. Gloria left with a smile on her face. They closed her eyes with the glare of the sun still on them, rolled the wheelchair up the hill, stayed a little while looking out over the land until the insects of evening gathered. They buried her 2 days later in a plot near the back of her old house. She'd told Jaslyn once that everyone knows where they're from when they know where it is they want to be buried. A quiet ceremony, just the girls and a preacher. They put Gloria in the ground with one of her father's old hand-painted signs and a sewing tin she'd kept from her own mother. If there was any good way to go, it was a good way to go. Yes, she thinks. She would like to stay and be with Claire also. Spend a few moments, find some silence, let the moments crawl. She's even brought her pajamas, her toothbrush, her comb. But it is clear to her now that she's not welcome. She had forgotten that there might be others too, that a life is lived in many ways, so many unopened envelopes.
May I see her?
I don't think she should be disturbed.
I'll just pop my head around the door.
It's a little late. She's sleeping. Would you like another drink? His voice rises high on the question, unfinished, as if searching for her name. But he knows her name. Idiot. A crass, lumbering fool. He wants to own the grief and throw a party for it.
Jaslyn, she says, and smiles thinly.
Another drink, Jaslyn?
Thank you, no, she says. I have a room at the Regis.
The Regis? Awesome.
It's the fanciest hotel she can think of, the most expensive place. She has no idea even where it is, just somewhere nearby, but the name changes Tom's face. He smiles and shows his very white teeth. She wraps a napkin around the bottom of her drink, places it down on the glass coffee table. Well, I should say goodnight. It's been a pleasure.
Please, I'll show you down.
It's okay, really.
No, no, I insist.
He touches her elbow and she cringes. She resists the urge to ask him if he's ever been president of a frat house. Really, she says at the elevator, I can let myself out. He leans forward to kiss her cheek. She allows him her shoulder, and she gives a slight nudge against his chin. Goodbye, she says with a sing-song finality. Downstairs, Melvin hails her a cab, and soon she is alone again, as if none of the evening has happened at all. She checks in her pocket for the card from Pino, turns it over in her fingers. It's as if she can feel the phone already ringing itself out in his pocket. The only room at the St. Regis costs $425 for the night. She thinks about trying to find another hotel, even thinks about a phone call to Pino, but then slides her credit card across the counter. Her hands shake. It's almost a month and a half's rent in Little Rock. The girl behind the desk asks for ID. Not a moment worth arguing over, though the couple in front of her were not asked for theirs. The room is tiny. The television sits high on the wall. She clicks on the remote. The end of the storm. No hurricanes this year. Baseball scores, football scores, another 6 dead in Iraq. She flops down on the bed, arms behind her head. She went to Ireland shortly after the attacks on Afghanistan. It was supposed to be a vacation. Her sister was part of the team coordinating the U.S. flights into Shannon Airport. They were spat on in the streets of Galway when they were leaving a restaurant. Fucking Yanks, go home! It wasn't as bad as being called a nigger, which happened when they rented a car and ended up on the wrong side of the road. Ireland surprised her. She had expected back roads of green and high hedges, men with locks of dark hair, isolated white cottages on the hills. Instead, she got flyovers and ramps and lectures from heavy-faced drunks on just exactly what world policy meant. She found herself pulling into a shell, unable to listen. She'd heard bits and pieces about the man, Corrigan, who had died alongside her mother. She wanted to know more. Her sister was the opposite. Janice wanted nothing to do with the past. The past embarrassed her. The past was a jet that was coming in with dead bodies from the Middle East. So she drove to Dublin without her sister. She didn't know why, but slow tears caught in her eyelashes. She had to squeeze them out to restore her vision of the road. She drew in deep, silent breaths as the roads grew bigger. It was easy enough to find Corrigan's brother. He was the CEO of an internet company in the high glass towers along the Liffey. "Come and see me," he said on the phone. Dublin was a boomtown, neon along the river. The seagulls embroidered it. Ciarán was in his early 60s, with a small peninsula of hair on his forehead, half an American accent. His other office, he said, was in Silicon Valley. He was impeccably dressed in a suit and expensive open-necked shirt, gray chest hair peeking out. They sat in his office, and he talked her through a life of his late brother Corrigan, a life that seemed rare and radical to her. Outside the window, cranes swung on the skyline. The Irish light seemed lengthy. He took her across the river to a pub, tucked down an alleyway, a genuine pub, all hardwood and beer scent. A row of silver kegs outside. She ordered a pint of Guinness. Was my mother in love with him? He laughed. Oh, I don't think so, no. Are you sure? That day, he was just giving her a lift home, that's all. I see. He was in love with another woman. From South America. I can't remember where. Colombia, I think. Or Nicaragua. Oh. She recognized the need for her mother to have been in love at least once. That's a pity, she said, her eyes moistening. She scoured her sleeve across her eyes. She hated the sight of tears, any time. Showy and sentimental, the last thing she wanted. Ciarán had no idea what to do with her. He went outside and called his wife on his cell phone. Jaslyn stayed at the bar and drank another beer. Felt warm but lightheaded. Maybe Corrigan had secretly loved her mother. Maybe they were on their way to a rendezvous. Perhaps a deep love had struck them both at the last instant. It occurred to her that her mother would only be 45 or 46 years old if she were still alive. They might have been friends. They could have talked about these things, could have sat in a bar together, spent some time, shared a beer. But it was ridiculous, really. How could her mother have crawled away from that life and started anew? How could she have walked away intact? With what? Sweeping brooms? Dustpans? Here we go, honey. Grab my high-heeled boots, put them in the wagon. Westward we go. Stupid, she knew. Still, just one evening, to sit with her mother and watch the way she painted her nails, maybe, or see the way she put coffee in a cup. Or watch her kick her shoes off. A single moment of the ordinary. Running the bath, humming out of tune, cutting the toast. Anything at all. Up a lazy river, how happy we could be. Ciarán breezed back into the pub and said to her in a distinctly American accent, "Guess who's coming to dinner?" He drove a brand new silver Audi. The house was just off the seafront, whitewashed, with roses out front and a dark ironwork fence. It was the same place the brothers had grown up. He'd sold it once and had to buy it back for over $1 million. "Can you believe it?" he said. "$1 million plus." His wife, Lara, was working in the garden, snipping roses with pruning shears. She was kind, slim, gentle. Her gray hair pulled back into a bun. She had the bluest eyes. They looked like small drops of September sky. She pulled her gardening gloves off. There were spatters of color on her hands. She drew Jaslyn close, held her for a moment longer than expected. She smelled of paint. Inside, there was a lot of artwork on the walls. They wandered around, a glass of crisp white wine for each of them. She liked the paintings. Radical Dublin landscapes, translated as line, shadow, color. Lara had published an art book and managed to sell some in the outdoor art shows in Marion Square. But she had lost, she said, her American touch. There was something of the beautiful failure about her. They ended up in the back garden again, sitting at the patio, a bone of white light in the sky. Ciarán talked of the Dublin real estate market. But really, Jaslyn felt they were talking about hidden losses, not profits, all the things they had passed by over the years. After dinner, all three walked along the seafront together, past the Martello Tower, and back around. The stars over Dublin sat like paint marks in the sky. The tide was long gone. An enormous stretch of sand disappeared into black. That way's England, said Ciarán, for no reason she could discern. He put his jacket around her, and Lara took her elbow, walked along, wedged between them. She broke free as delicately as she could, drove back to Limerick first thing the next morning. Her sister's face was glowing. Janice had just met a man. He was on his third tour, she said. Imagine that. He wore size 14 boots, she added with a wink. Her sister got shipped to the embassy in Baghdad 2 years ago. Every now and then she still gets a postcard from her. One of them is a picture of a woman in a burqa. Fun in the sun. The day dawns winter bright. She finds out in the morning that breakfast is not included in her hotel bill. She can only smile. $425. Breakfast not included. Upstairs, she takes all the soaps from the bathroom, the lotion, the shoeshine cloth, but still leaves a tip for the housekeepers. She walks in the neighborhood for coffee, up north from 55th Street. The whole world of Starbucks, and she can't find a single one. She settles on a small deli, cream in her coffee, a bagel with butter. She circles back around to Claire's apartment, stands outside, looks up. It's a beautiful building, brickworked and corniced, but it's too early to stop by yet, she decides. She turns and walks east toward the subway, her small bag slung over her shoulder. She loves the immediate energy of the village. It's as if all the guitars have suddenly taken to the fire escapes. Sunlight on the brickwork, flower pots in high windows. She's wearing an open blouse and tight jeans. She feels at ease, as if the streets are releasing her. A man passes her with a dog inside his shirt. She smiles and watches them go. The dog crawls to the top of the man's shoulder and looks back at her, its eyes large and tender. She waves, sees the dog disappear down the man's shirt again. She finds Pino in a coffee shop on Mercer Street. It's just as easy as she's imagined. She has no idea why, but she was convinced that it would be simple to find him. She could have called him on his cell phone, but decided against it. Better to seek him out, find him in this city of millions. He's alone and hunched over a coffee, reading a copy of La Repubblica. She has the sudden fear that there's a woman somewhere nearby. Perhaps even one who's due to join him at any moment. But she doesn't care. She buys a coffee and slides back the chair, joins him at the table. He lifts his reading glasses to the top of his forehead and leans back in the chair, laughs. How did you find me? My internal GPS. How was your jazz? Oh, it was jazz. Your old friend, how is she? Not sure yet. Yet. I'll see her later today. Tell me, can I ask, just, well, you know, what brings you here? The city? You really want to know, he says.
I think so, yeah.
Are you ready?
As I'll ever be.
I'm buying a chess set.
You what?
It's a handmade thing. There's a craftsman on Thompson Street. I'm picking it up. It's a bit of an obsession of mine. It's for my son, actually. It's a special Canadian wood, and the guy is a master.
You came all the way from Little Rock to pick up a chess set?
I suppose I needed to get out for a while.
No kidding.
And, well, I'll bring it to him in Frankfurt, spend a few days with him, have some fun, go back to Little Rock, return to work.
How's your carbon footprint?
He smiles, drains his coffee. She can already tell that they will spend the morning here, that they will while the time away in the village. They will have an early lunch. He will lean forward and touch her neck. She will cradle his hand there. They will go to his hotel. They will make love. They will open the curtains. They will tell stories. They will laugh. She will fall asleep again with her hand on his chest. She will kiss him goodbye. And later, back in Arkansas, he will call on her message machine, and she will leave his number on her night desk to decide.
Another question.
Yeah?
How many pictures of women are on your cell phone?
Not many, he says with a grin.
And you, how many guys?
Millions, she says.
Really?
Billions, in fact. There was only one time she ever went back to the Deegan. It was 10 years ago, when she had just finished college. She wanted to know where it was her mother and grandmother had strolled. She drove a rental from JFK Airport, got stopped in traffic, bumper to bumper. At least a half mile of cars up ahead. In the rearview mirror, the traffic pinned her into place, a Bronx sandwich. So, she was home again. But it didn't feel like a homecoming. She hadn't been in the neighborhood since she was 5. She remembered the pale gray corridors and a mailbox stuffed with flyers. That was all. She put the car in park and was fidgeting with her stereo when she caught a glimpse of movement far up the road. A man was rising out from the top of a limousine, strange and centurion. She saw his head first, then his torso coming up through the open sunroof. Then the sharp swivel of his head, as if he had been shot. She fully expected a spray of blood along his roof. Instead, the man extended his arm and pointed as if directing traffic. He swiveled again. Each turn was quicker and quicker. He was like an odd conductor wearing a suit and tie. The outstretched tie looked like a dial on the roof of the car as he turned. His hands rose on either side of him, and he pulled his whole body up through the sunroof, and then he was out and standing on top of the limousine, legs splayed wide and his fingers outstretched, roaring at nearby drivers. She noticed then that others were out and about with their arms draped over their open doors, a little row of heads turning in the same direction like sunflowers. Some secret between them. A nearby woman started beeping her car horn. She heard screaming, and it was then that she noticed the coyote trotting through the traffic. It looked entirely calm, loping along in the hot sun, stopping and twisting its body as if it were in some weird wonderland to be marveled at. The thing was that the coyote was going toward the city, not back out. She remained seated and watched it come toward her. It crossed lanes, 2 cars in front of her, passed alongside her window. It didn't look up, but she could see the yellow of the eyes. In the rearview mirror, she watched it go. She wanted to scream at it to turn, that it was going the wrong way. It needed to double back, just swivel and sprint free. Far behind her, she noticed siren lights turning. Animal control. 3 men with nets were circling through the traffic. When she heard the crack of the rifle shot, she thought at first it was just a car backfiring. She likes the word mother and all the complications it brings. She isn't interested in true or birth or adoptive, or whatever other series of mothers there are in the world. Gloria was her mother. Jaslyn was too. They were like strangers on a porch. Gloria and Jaslyn, with the evening sun going down. They just sat there together, and neither could say what the other one knew, so they just kept quiet and watched the day descend. One of them said goodnight, while the other waited. They find each other slowly, tentatively, shyly, drawing apart, merging again, and it strikes her that she has never really known the body of another. Afterward, they lie together without speaking, their bodies touching lightly, until she rises and dresses quietly. The flowers are cheap, she thinks, the moment she buys them. Waxy flower paper, thin blooms, a strange scent to them, like someone in the deli has sprayed them with a false fragrance. Still, she can find no other open florist, and the light is dimming, the evening disappearing. She heads west toward Park, her body still tingling, his phantom hand at her hip. In the elevator, the cheap scent of flowers rises. She should have looked around and found a better shop, but it's too late now. No matter. She gets out on the top floor, her shoes sinking into the soft carpet. There's a newspaper on the ground by Claire's door, the slick hysteria of war. 18 dead today. A shiver along her arms. She rings the doorbell, props the flowers against the frame as she hears the latches click. It is the Jamaican nurse who opens the front door for her again. His face is broad and relaxed. He wears short dreadlocks. Oh, hi. Is there anyone else here? Excuse me, he says. Just wondering if there's anybody else home. Her nephew's in the other room. He's napping. How long has he been here? Tom? He spent the night. He's been here a few days. He's been having people over. There's a momentary standoff, as if the nurse is trying to figure out just exactly why she's returned, what she wants, how long she'll stay. He keeps his hand around the doorframe, but then he leans forward and whispers conspiratorially. He brought a couple of real estate people to his parties, you know. Jaslyn smiles, shakes her head. It doesn't matter. She won't allow it to matter. Do you think I can see her? Be my guest. You know she had a stroke, right? Yes. She stops in the hallway. Did you get my card? I sent a big, goofy card. Oh, that's yours, says the nurse. That one's funny. I like that one. He sweeps his hand along the corridor, points her down toward the room. She moves through the half-dark, as if pushing back a veil. She stops, turns the glass handle on the bedroom door. It clicks. The door swings. She feels as if she's stepping off a ledge. The room looks dark and heavy, a thick tenor to it, a tiny triangle of light where the curtains don't quite meet. She stands a moment to let her eyes adjust. Jaslyn wants to part the dark, open the curtains, crack the window, but Claire is asleep, eyelids closed. She pulls up a chair by the bed beside a saline drip. The drip isn't attached. There's a glass on the bedside table, and a straw, and a pencil, and a newspaper, and her card among many other cards. She peers in the dark. Get well soon, you funny old bird. She isn't sure now whether it's humorous at all. Perhaps she should have bought something cute and demure. You never know. You cannot know. The rise and fall of Claire's chest. The body a thin failure now. The shrunken breasts, the deep lids, the striated neck, the intricate articulation. Her life painted on her, receding on her. A brief flutter of her eyelids. Jaslyn leans close. A waft of stale air. an eyelid flutter once more. The eyes open and stare. In the dark, they're whites. Claire opens her eyes wider still, does not smile or say a word. A pull on the sheets. Jaslyn looks down as Claire moves her left hand. The fingers go up and down as if playing a piano. The yellow ruffle work of age. The person we know at first, she thinks, is not the one we know at last. A clock sounds. Little else to distract attention from the evening. Just a clock, in a time not too distant from the present time, yet a time not too distant from the past. The unaccountable unfolding of consequence into tomorrow's time. The simple things. The grain of bedwood, alive and light. The slight argument of dark still left in the old woman's hair. The ray of moisture on the plastic life bag. The curl of the braided flower petal. The chipped edge of a photo frame. The rim of a mug. The mark of a stray tea line along its edge. A crossword puzzle sitting unfinished. The yellow of a pencil dangling over the edge of the table. One end sharpened, the eraser in midair. Fragments of a human order. Jaslyn turns the pencil around to safety, then rises, rounds the far end of the bed toward the window. Her hands on the windowsill. She parts the curtains a little more, opens the triangle, lifts the window frame minutely, feels the curl of breeze on her skin, the ash, the dust, the light now pressing the dark out of things. We stumble on now. We drain the light from the dark to make it last. She lifts the window higher. Sounds outside growing clearer in the silence. Traffic at first. Machine hum, crane work, playgrounds, children. The tree branches down on the avenue slapping each other around. The curtain falls back, but still a corridor of brightness has opened up on the carpet. Jaslyn steps to the bed again, takes off her shoes, drops them. Claire parts her lips ever so slightly. Not a word, but a difference in her breathing, a measured grace. We stumble on, thinks Jaslyn, bring a little noise into the silence, find in others the ongoing of ourselves. It's almost enough. Quietly, Jaslyn perches on the edge of the bed and then extends her feet, moves her legs across slowly so as not to disturb the mattress. She fixes a pillow, leans, picks a hair out of Claire's mouth. Jaslyn thinks again of an apricot. She doesn't know why, but that's what she thinks. The skin of it, the savor, the sweetness. The world spins. We stumble on. It's enough. She lies on the bed beside Claire above the sheets, the faint tang of the old woman's breath on the air, the clock, the fan, the breeze, the world spinning.
The End. You've been listening to Let the Great World Spin by Colin McCann. All respects to Heaven, I Like It Here, the chapter on Chiron, was read by Gerard Doyle. Miro, Miro on the Wall, the chapter on Claire, was read by Carol Monda. A Fear of Love, the chapter on Lara, was read by Johanna Parker. Tag, the chapter on Fernando, was read by Ramon de Ocampo. Ether West, the chapter on Sam Peters, was read by Chris Sorensen. This is the House That Horse Built, the chapter on Tilly, was read by Patricia R. Floyd. Part of the Parts, the chapter on Solomon Soderbergh, was read by Jim Frangione. Centavos, the chapter on Adelita, was read by Alma Cuervo. All Hail and Hallelujah, the chapter on Gloria, was read by Lizanne Mitchell. Roaring Seaward and I Go, the chapter on Jaslyn, was read by Charisse Booth. The intervening passages of this book were read by me, your host, Richard Poe. and this production was directed by Rob Grannis.
Whole Story Audiobooks. The whole story as the author intended.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.